guilt complex.
Okay. We are wrapping up Revelation 21 and moving to Revelation 22 today. And we've looked at, well, let's pick it up. We're going to kind of look at another feature here. We've looked a lot at the matter of transparency, and I want us to look at that just a little bit more in connection with another feature of the Eternal City, which is not Rome, fortunately. But this one really is forever. And in verse 23, it says, "The city has no need of the sun or of the moon to shine upon it, for the glory of God has illumined it, and its lamp is the Lamb. And the nation shall walk by its light, and the kings of the earth shall bring their glory into it." And then it mentions that there is no night there in verse 25, and it talks about the gates not being closed, which we talked about a good bit last time. But here, you got two key things, transparency and light, okay? And we've talked a good bit about that matter of transparency. And here, by the way, it does not say that there is no sun or any moon. As a matter of fact, something else we'll see in a little bit seems to indicate that there probably is a moon, okay? But it just says that there's no need for it in the city. It doesn't apply what it says. Now, maybe you don't need it anywhere else either, but it doesn't. It's not stating that the whole earth has no need of the sun, but simply the city and this light that would pervade everything. This is, you know, you have here the ultimate lighting system. Okay. It's kind of interesting. Have you ever noticed there's always a difference in artificial light? You know, it's never quite the same. And there's, you know, a variety of reasons for that. But when you think about it, you know, things are always casting shadows, and it seems like the light bulb is always in the wrong place or something like that. It's very hard to get it positioned and, you know, right. Whereas that's not going to be an issue here, because there's a couple of possibilities, and that is that the light that comes from God's presence, wherever it is exactly in the city, passes through virtually everything because it's more or less transparent, okay? So that would be one factor. And you would have this warm glow, too, because everything seems to have this sort of golden hue. Now, speaking of colors, we'll come back to that in a little bit, too. But so, you know, you kind of, the idea here that the picture you get is very, you know, it's pervasive light, but it's warm light that is in the sense of not harsh or glaring or any of those sorts of things. And the fact that it's going to virtually come from everywhere. So you have kind of the ultimate indirect lighting, you know, as light passes through. I mean, that's why they put those things, not the bugs, but the the plastic things, you know, it diffuses the light, and that's kind of what you have as an effect in this city. Even though the light ultimately has one source, it would just spread and be reflected and refracted and so on and so forth. It's got to be just awesome, okay? Just from a purely physical standpoint. And so the source of light here is the Lord and the Lamb. And once again, you have this much closer link between the Lamb and it would be God the Father here. And that's exactly what we, again, expect based on what Paul talks about, how basically the kingdom of Christ, which finds its fulfillment in the millennium, isn't phased out, it's phased in. That is, it's phased into this eternal arrangement where the distinction between God and Christ is what would you say? It's blurred, is definitely not the word. But it's more blended, I guess, is a better word. We have them constantly mentioned in the same breath. as opposed to, you know, God's on the throne, then the Lamb appears, as we had earlier in the book and so forth. So you don't have that now, because things have reached their ultimate state. And then it talks about the nations walking by its light and the kings of the earth bringing their glory into it. This, by the way, is an important thing to realize, that the city isn't the only thing. And the whole planet is active. Okay, what size the earth will be at that point, you know, we're not really told. Maybe it'll be virtually the same size it is today. Maybe it'll be much larger. Maybe smaller. But we don't know. But the point is that the city rests on the earth, and the new earth, and there's a lot going on the whole planet. And so there, and it's not like, you know, everybody's locked in this city. Okay, it's not like being in a spaceship where, you know, you can't ever get out, you know, except in a pod or something, you know. But it's you, and what the, you know, as we have this vivid description of the earth, we don't have, I mean, of the city, but we don't have much description of the earth. But you know, if as messed up as the planet is by sin and human behavior and all the various things, the curse, you know, as spectacular as it can be, we watched a little thing on Yellowstone last night. Well, we slept through part of it, but we saw a good bit of it. And you know, it's just awesome. I mean, it's just and you know, the whole planet is going to be reconstructed in a way that we probably can't begin to imagine. So it's just going to be really something else. So, yeah, John.
It looks like there's still going to be sin in the earth because it cannot come into the city.
That would not be the case, because all sin at this point has been confined to the lake of fire, which is somewhere else.
But nothing unclean will ever enter.
That's right, because it can't get anywhere near it. Yeah, yeah, I can see where you're kind of coming from, because as if the gates would prevent, but remember, the gates don't need to be closed.
Right.
So there isn't anybody on planet Earth except the redeemed anymore. And there is, yeah, sin would be completely eliminated. And also the fact that there is, as it says, there's no more curse. There's no more sorrow. There's no more crying. There's all those things that are a result of sin are gone, not just in the city, but in the new heavens and new earth. All that is sinful has been completely confined to the lake of fire. Where that is in relationship to the new heavens and earth, we're not told, and it doesn't matter. It's going to be irrelevant, I guess. Which, by the way, brings up another question. I remember a pastor asking a while back, and unfortunately I wasn't in a position to answer his question, but I could have. But he was reading from Isaiah 66, which speaks of the new heavens and new earth, and then it talks about people going and looking and observing the smoke of the torment of the people who are being punished. And the question he asked was, you know, can somebody explain to me, you know, how in the new heavens and new earth, you could see people being tormented in the lake of fire? Well, I could have answered that question, because the answer to that question is, that's not what it says. If you read it carefully, when it refers to the new heavens and new earth, it says, as the new heavens and new earth. It's talking about something that lasts forever. And, hey, Jen. So, yeah, we don't want to make you feel conspicuous coming in.
Here I am.
We're glad you're here. Okay. So, but the scene that you have there in Isaiah 66 would be at the beginning or at some point in the millennium, but I think at the beginning of the millennium. When you have a series of judgments that take place, and that's what it's talking about. But like I say, if you read it carefully, it doesn't say that this is happening in the new heavens and new earth. It's saying it's, in terms of its duration, it's like the new heavens and new earth, and its promise is like the new heavens and new earth. So, So at this point, when we get past the great white throne judgment, all that is out of the picture from the standpoint of human consciousness entirely. And I think that's part of what happens when it says God will wipe away every tear. Because just prior to that, there would be reason for a lot of tears on the part of saved people. And that should be a strong motivator for us. One day that'll be out of sight and truly out of mind, but, you know, our next study we'll be doing, Lord willing, will be on personal evangelism. And, you know, this is a powerful motivator to reach people with the gospel. And we'll kind of come back. But that's a really good question. I could see where you might think from what it says, it's like the bad stuff is being locked out of the city. But that's not actually what it's saying. It's just saying there's not going to be any of that there. And there won't be any on earth either. So, good question. Okay. But it repeatedly, actually there's three times, and that threefold repetition is important in the Bible, where it talks about the purity, the moral purity of the city, and that no one enters the city who has these various practices. For instance, verse 27, nothing unclean, and no one who practices abomination. And interestingly enough, what's the next thing it mentions? 27 of chapter 21. Lying. This plays a prominent role. Each list is a bit different, but every one of them includes this one. Because it's really at the core of all the other problems. When we don't face the truth, we open the door to every problem in the book. That's what's happened in our country. We are not willing to face the truth, and so everything else has happened. Okay, and as Jesus said, Satan was a what from the beginning? Liar. That's where it all starts. So, you know. And Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. Okay. The idea of these bringing this glory and honor of the nations would indicate that there's a lot going on planet Earth outside the city. Okay. And this also, by the way, parallels some things that were part of the promises to Israel in terms of when they repented and turned back to the Lord. And so this kind of thing actually continues, but it continues at a whole different level than it was in the millennium. It will be true in the millennium as far as Gentile nations will be making massive contributions to Jerusalem and so on and so forth, bringing things in. And, you know, there's little predecessors to that in the Old Testament. For instance, where did David get most of the material for the temple? Solomon built it, but David collected most of the material. Where did he get it from?
He got a lot of stuff from the cedars of Lebanon.
Yeah, Hiram of Tyre. Which, interestingly enough, is a country that's under curses. Yeah, but David had a friendship with Hiram. I don't know if Hiram came to know the Lord. I don't know what happened there, but it's interesting that even going back to the building of the first temple, you have this huge contribution is being made by Gentile nations. And that picture just kind of keeps amplifying as you go through the Bible. The point here is that there's a lot going on. You know, the concept of heaven as, you know, sitting on a cloud strumming a harp forever, you know, just doesn't, I mean, no, it's not there. I mean, it's just, it's just not there. I mean, you've got things about clouds, and you've got things about harps, and you got, you know, and all this, but that's just sort of been put together in a very fanciful, artificial.
We're not really told that we have work to do, but it would seem we would have something to do.
Yeah. We certainly would. I mean, in the garden, before there was sin, there were things for them to do. They were to dress and keep the garden. God made it, but, you know, they were in charge of taking care of it and so forth. And so they had things to do. The difference in the curse was you kind of have Murphy's Law introduced to work, where, you know, you're working, you're working, and it doesn't work, you know. And, you know, you start getting weeds and this sort of thing. So you have to work extra hard to get relatively little and so on and so forth. And whereas it wouldn't have been like that in the garden. What's the old expression? If you enjoy your work, you never work a day in your life. And it's kind of like that. What we'll be doing, it'll be our work in eternity is going to be more fun and exciting than the biggest thrill ride you ever took or whatever you like to do for exhilaration. Okay, I mean, it's just, this is going to be just amazing.
There won't be any human resources offices.
Yeah, it won't be necessary. Yeah, that's right. Yep. No complaints department, you know. I'm not sure how much good those do anyway. But anyway, bear with me. I tend to get a little cynical on some things. But okay. So, yeah, this is going to be amazing. So, you know, making the point that it's a very active place. But let's come down to, unless somebody got a question or observation. Okay. Chapter 22 and verse 1, it says, here we have another major feature of the New Jerusalem. He says, he showed me a river of the water of life, clear as crystal, coming from the throne of God and of the Lamb. We'll get to verse 2, which actually verse 2 gives interpreters a lot of cramps. Okay. We'll talk about that in a minute. Let's start with what's clear here, no pun intended, but clear is a big part of this, okay? So you have this river. So the river of a city, what's its source? Yeah, well, specifically, the throne, okay? And there's several things here about a river. Cities can't function without a major water source. And it has to come in and it has to go out. You cannot support life in a city without a massive flow of water. That's just, you know, part of it. And, you know, if you think about Jerusalem, one of the wonders of the ancient world was the aqueduct that was dug by King Hezekiah in preparation for siege by the Assyrians. And it is awesome. In the days before GPSs and other, you know, technical advances and so forth, that basically the idea was to channel water from the massive Gihon spring into the city, and getting the water out was not as big a problem, but you had to get it into the city without it being a potential route for the enemy to get into the city. But under siege, you couldn't get out and get water. You couldn't go to the, you know, spring or whatever. So he, through solid rock, had this tunnel dug. You can see it today. It's got ancient inscriptions on it and everything. They discovered it, I don't know, it was the 40s or 50s. I can't remember when they found this thing. But it was an aqueduct bringing water into the city of Jerusalem. So even if they were under siege, they would have an adequate water supply. Modern cities could only grow to be so large until the development of massive plumbing and sewer systems that developed and made possible to have cities the size that we have them today. Water's key ingredient. You can't have life without water. And so this is a prominent feature in cities throughout history. And it's interesting thing about this water. I saw a little piece of a documentary on on underground London, and there are a number of rivers in London that you can't see because they put them underground. Okay, and the reason they put them underground is because they are nasty, and that's being polite. I mean, it's just unspeakably horrible. Okay, I mean, and I don't want to get into all the gory details of how bad it was, but it was bad. And so they basically buried these rivers because they were so polluted and nasty and causing disease and stench, and I mean, it's just awful. And they're buried to this day. And they're still nasty and all that. Maybe not quite as bad as they were then, but still pretty bad. Okay? This river is quite different. Okay? Right? And it's interesting, you know, normally it didn't matter whether it was Babylon or Jerusalem or any of the cities of Egypt or any of the great cities, Nineveh, Rome, all these all had waters. And of course, the Romans were famous for building aqueducts, and they made major advances in this whole area and so forth. But the water always had to come from where? Inside or outside the city?
Outside.
Okay, they had to bring it in and then get rid of it. So it came in, it went out. None of them had the city as the source of the water. And this is different. And interestingly enough, and this is a different situation, but prior to this, Ezekiel gives a description of Jerusalem during the thousand-year reign of Christ, the millennium, in which there is a similar river that starts at the door of the temple. And those of you here, when we studied the covenants, we talked a little bit about the rivers used to run backwards. Okay? Not meaning that they ran uphill, but rather that, like today, rivers start running down hills, and then they, you know, collect, you know, just like we have the, you know, we got the Yadkin, and then it dumps into the PD, and it dumps into blah, blah, blah. Okay. And so we have all these systems collecting. The river gets bigger and bigger until it goes into the ocean. In the pre-flood world, anybody remember where the river started? It started as one river and flowed out and became four rivers. But where did it start? In the Garden of Eden. Yeah. The place where God was dwelling with man. In the millennium, you're going to have this river that starts inside the city and goes out. In the eternal state, it takes it to an even greater level, and we have this river that starts and flows out from the throne of God. All this, of course, points to a number of things. Who is the source of everything, especially life? God is. And so this river, I believe it's a literal, physical H2O river, okay? But it is a river that depicts a deeper and more profound reality, and that is that God is the source of everything, and especially of life. And it's a constant reminder. It all comes from Him. You can see it. Okay? All right? And so this reminder that He is the source. By the way, that means you don't need rain. And there's no more sea either. So what does this river flow into? I don't know. You know? A giant underground reservoir? Possibly. But it doesn't really matter. You know, the fact is that it has its source at the throne and comes from the presence of God. And then another thing that's interesting about it, we were talking about this transparency. It says that it is clear as crystal. Anybody have anything different there in the description?
Sparkling like crystal.
Sparkling like crystal is interesting. That's an interesting point. Why do they say sparkling? Because the word for clear here is different from the other words that we looked at. for clear or transparent. Okay? And this one, in Greek it looks like this. Okay? I don't know how much that helps, but if we change that into English letters, it looks like... Does that look familiar? That's where we get our lamp. Do you have any idea how much Greek you knew? Okay. This is the same word that's used when it says that Jesus is the lamp of the city. Okay? It's also the same word that's used for what we know, Hebrew. Menorah. And in Greek, this word, the candlestick, the candelabra, really, we would call it, okay, is called this. Okay. By the way, it's different from the torches that represent the seven spirits or the sevenfold spirit of God, however you interpret that. It's a different term. This is the idea, and this would all harken back to, but it's the idea. You know, if you have a torch, you know, you think big flame, you know, kind of whoo sort of thing, okay. But if you have a lampstand like this, smaller lights, and they sort of twinkle, right? And hence, sometimes this word is used to mean sparkling. So this is sparkling water. Now I don't know that it's carbonated, okay? But the idea is that it is so clear that it twinkles. Okay? Can you picture that in your mind? You know, it's just kind of
water catches the light.
Yeah, it does, and it and you get all these little. Yeah, that's the idea. This is just dazzling. Okay, is the idea. Because you got all this light, you got all this transparency, and you got this water moving, and it's just sparkling, and I mean, it's just, you know, it would be reflecting little things all over the place. I mean, it's just, okay. By the way, think about, where's the main place that this is found? Menorah. Yeah, in the temple, in the holy place. And I don't know if you remember or not, when they built the tabernacle, if you walked into the tabernacle, what was the only source of light you had? That, right there. And what color was it in there? Well, there was some blue. Yeah, but this would be... Remember, the walls were made of planks that were completely overlaid with gold. And we've already talked about how the dominant color of the New Jerusalem is what?
Gold.
And so you have this picture. And, of course, what was the tabernacle? It was a picture of God's dwelling place. Okay? A little tiny miniature, you know, and given the materials to work with, you know, primitive, but... You see the pattern. By the way, another thing that's kind of interesting about all this, if you think about the color scheme, if you look at all those different stones and that it mentions, the precious stones of the, particularly of the foundations and so forth, you have every color in the rainbow involved there. Interestingly enough, the dominant color is green. Next to that would be gold, as far as, so you got this overall gold, you have a lot of greens, different kinds of greens, and then you got everything else. You got violet and indigo, and you got blue, and you got red, and you got stripes, and you got I mean, all kinds of different things going on. Plus you got the pearls, which, you know, I mean, so all this is reflecting, and those colors were also colors that were incorporated into the tapestries of the temple, and particularly the veil. It had those same basic colors in it. And so overall, you're going to get a similar visual effect to the tabernacle that God told Moses to construct. Okay. Interesting. But like I said, on a whole different level here. This is awesome. And the tabernacle was not clear, right? Not at all. Okay, it was very opaque. It had layers and layers of cloth and skins and so on and so forth. And it would have shut out all the external light. So, but it does reflect the fact that the only sources of light in the tabernacle were the menorah and then the actual glory of God in the most holy place. Because the menorah wasn't in the most holy place. So in those two compartments, you had the menorah and interference. Okay. So, anyway, I just think it's interesting to look at some of these parallels. And so we've got this this river, the water of life, and of course this reaches back throughout the Bible, and we could spend several classes looking at that. But verse 2, it says, in the middle of its street. Now, you might have it worded slightly different. Anybody got something?
In the street of it.
In the street of it. Okay. The question is, it what? Okay. Now, in English, we got some teachers here. If you have a pronoun, it should be referring to the nearest what?
Antecedent.
The nearest thing that's actually identified. That's not true in Greek, okay? Because and it is an it, okay? And certain words are, you know, if they're people or animals, they might be he or she, and then the rest of them are its, okay? But that's not true in Greek, it's not true in German either, by the way. A table has a particular gender, and a door has a different gender, and they might be neuter, but they might be masculine or feminine. That's why one is...
Hebrew is like that.
Yeah, Hebrew is like that, and so is Greek. And the pronouns have gender so that you can tell what goes with what. So they don't worry about putting it right next to what it's talking about. The street of it, the it here is feminine. And the nearest feminine thing you've got goes all the way back to the city. So it's the street of the city, not the street of the river or the street of the throne, but the street of the city.
Okay. My version says that, the street of the city.
Yeah, and that's quite right. Okay? It's just, you know, when you just translate it word for word, you can't really tell, and most translations do that. Okay. So, so here we see another key feature of the city. In addition to the river, we also have a
street.
Well, we have a street, and then we're going to get to the tree. Okay? The next part is what has people confused. By the way, the street here, is this a highway? Is it an elevator? I mean, this thing is 1,500 miles high, you know. And we assume that the throne is probably at the top, whatever shape it might be. You know, how do you get there? Or is it like a great spiral thing? Who knows? I don't know. But there is a street there. Okay, it only mentions one. And I don't know if we really would need streets, but there is one. And it says in the middle of the street and on either side of the river was what? The tree of life. And we'll have to come back to this, but here's what interpreters puzzle over. You can puzzle over this for next time we talk about it. But how do you picture this? What's in the middle of what? And how can it be in the middle? And how would you draw this? Okay, it gets a little confusing. Now, that leads some people to say, well, see, this can't be actual. It's just out there. Well,
why is it confusing?
Well,
streets with trees on the sides.
Well, but how many trees does it mention?
the river would have to go down through the middle of the street because the trees are on either side of the river and in the middle of the street.
But here's the thing, okay? You said trees.
Yep, there are 12 varieties.
It says 12 fruits, but it doesn't say 12 trees.
One tree.
It says which bore 12 fruits, and each tree yielding its fruit every month.
Yeah.
Sounds like more trees to me.
Yeah, in your translation, it does say that. In the original, and that's one way of interpreting this.
Yeah.
You can't tell from the original. It really only meant in the original, it only states one tree. Now, that doesn't mean that it can only be one tree, but that's what. So, depending on how you take that, depends on how you try to recreate this picture. Your translation has opted for tree meaning a kind of tree, and so there's many of them. I kind of lean that direction too, but that's part of the question here. So, things.
So, do we know the 12 fruits?
No.
Okay.
No. It does, and even whether it's 12 different kinds of fruit is not 100% clear from the original. It is clear that it bears each month.
Yeah, each. Which is amazing.
Yes.
If you think about fruit trees.
Yeah. So you got it's this nonstop cycle. Okay. So when one stops bearing, the next one is bearing. How does all this work? Well, we can talk about that, and you can speculate on that a little bit. There's a lot we don't know here. There's different possibilities.
If somebody's an artist, they should draw a picture.
And some interpret it as meaning 12 kinds of fruit, and some simply interpret it as meaning that it bears 12 different times, once each month. But we don't know. And the leaves are important, too. We'll talk about that. So next week we'll be up a tree. All right. Okay. One of my favorite things to do, by the way. Who'd like to close in prayer? Okay.
Heavenly Father, thank you for all that we have to look forward to. We know you as Lord and Savior, and I just thank you for the Lord Jesus who pay the price for our sin that we might dwell with you eternally. And Lord, help us to remember that although we are looking for your coming and we are longing to be in your presence, that there are many people in our world who do not know you. And I pray that you will help us to be lights and witnesses to them. And now I ask that you be with Pastor Philip as he brings the morning message. And may we hear his words and apply them to our lives. May everything that happens in the service glorify you. In Jesus' name I pray.